we'll take the matter under consideration.
Thank you.
Next is in the matter of Joseph Peter Barrett. Council could please step forward. May we please have appearances?
Charles Centenaro on behalf of the Office of Attorney Ethics.
John McGill, McGill Law Practice, LLC, on behalf of the respondent, Joseph Barrett.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, Joseph Barrett.
Mr. Centenaro, please go ahead.
Chief Justice Ravner, Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court. We are here today on an order to show cause that was entered by this Court following its granting of a motion filed by the Office of Attorney Ethics seeking reconsideration of the court's order entered July 10, 2018, dismissing the OA's motion for reconsideration against respondent Joseph Peter Barrett. The principal issue for this court's determination is whether another court's findings of unethical conduct that were established by a preponderance of the evidence standard of proof are sufficient to form the basis of reciprocal discipline in New Jersey. And the answer to that question can be found in New Jersey Court Rule 1:20-14A4, which provides that on the filing of a motion for reciprocal discipline, the Disciplinary Review Board shall recommend the imposition of the identical action or discipline unless the respondent demonstrates or the board finds on the record that one of five enumerated exceptions applies. Implicit in the language of that sentence is an understanding and recognition that other states may employ a lower standard of proof than the clear and convincing evidence standard. Also implicit is that findings of unethical conduct found using a lower burden of proof will be accepted for purposes of reciprocal discipline, provided the Office of Attorney Ethics is not seeking the imposition of greater discipline. And that reading, I believe, is confirmed in the next section of the rule, 1:20-14A5, titled Conclusive Evidence, which provides that a final adjudication in another court that a New Jersey attorney is guilty of unethical conduct in the other jurisdiction establishes conclusively the facts on which it rests. In other words, a final adjudication of unethical conduct in another court is conclusive proof of that attorney's misconduct. There's no need for the Disciplinary Review Board to review the record again for the purpose of determining whether unethical conduct may have occurred. The board and this court may accept the determinations or findings of misconduct. The conclusive evidence rule makes no reference to differing burdens of proof. We know from the previous section that the court is aware that different states employ differing burdens of proof, but chose not to make reference to that, which suggests that the use of a different, lower standard of proof is no bar to the imposition of reciprocal discipline. Now, respondents' argument is that this reading of the rule is unreasonable, given the language in Rule 1:20-6C2B, which states that formal charges of unethical conduct shall be established by clear and convincing evidence. But respondents' reliance on that rule is misplaced. That rule only specifies the standard of proof to be applied when the Office of Attorney Ethics determines to prosecute a matter by way of a formal complaint requiring a hearing, which is why the clear and convincing evidence standard of proof language is found in Rule 1:20-6, which is that section of the disciplinary rules dealing with hearings. Subsections A and B of 1:20-6 talk about the designation and oversight of ethics panels and special ethics masters. Subsection C of that rule identifies when hearings are required and the standard of proof to be applied in those hearings. There is nothing in the rule that states or even suggests that the clear and convincing evidence standard is the standard that must be used when the Office of Attorney Ethics determines to proceed by way of the alternate procedure of filing a motion for reciprocal discipline. Now, the distinction between the rules and procedures applicable to disciplinary matters brought by way of formal complaint and those brought by way of a motion for reciprocal discipline was recognized by this court in In re Sigmund, where Justice Patterson, writing for the court, wrote on page 153, rules 1:20-3 through 9, and this would include 1:20-6, prescribe a detailed procedure for investigations, formal hearings, and appellate review in attorney ethics matters originating in New Jersey. In contrast to rules 1:20-3 through 9, our reciprocal discipline rule envisions a limited inquiry, substantially derived from and reliant on the foreign jurisdiction's disciplinary proceedings. So in other words, the rules and procedures applicable to matters originating in New Jersey and those coming from other jurisdictions are different. The clear and convincing evidence standard of proof found in 1:20-6 is applicable only to those matters originating in New Jersey. It's not applicable to reciprocal discipline matters, which are, and quoting the language of Sigmund again, are governed by their own special rules. The only time the clear and convincing evidence standard comes into play is when the Office of Attorney Ethics is seeking the imposition of greater discipline than that imposed in the other jurisdiction. This court has long accepted that a final adjudication in another court that an attorney admitted in this jurisdiction is guilty of unethical conduct establishes conclusively the facts on which it rests, even when the findings were made using a lower standard of proof. For example, 30 years ago, in In re Harris, 115 New Jersey 181, 1989, this court imposed reciprocal discipline of a 2-year suspension on an attorney who was found guilty of unethical conduct in New York. The standard of proof used in New York is, and still today, is a preponderance of the evidence. Now, a suggestion has been made that in the 30 years since Harris, the issue of what effect, if any, the use of a lower standard of proof in another jurisdiction has on reciprocal discipline in New Jersey has never been brought to the attention of the court. That's not true. In 2005, in In re Gurvitz, the Disciplinary Review Board discussed the issue and said even in those states where the burden of proof is not subject to the clear and convincing evidence standard, our Supreme Court has directed that we accept the determinations of misconduct as conclusively established, presumably as a matter of comity. This court, in its review of that decision, didn't correct that presumption. More recently, in 2014, in the matter of In re David Groom, this court imposed a 1-year suspension on a New York attorney who was censured after a special referee found by preponderance of the evidence that the attorney had engaged in an improper fee-sharing referral arrangement with a non-attorney. In that case, Mr. Groom's attorney, David Dugan, raised the issue of the difference in the standards of proof used in New York and New Jersey. He raised the issue to the DRB, and he raised it again to this court. But this court nevertheless imposed reciprocal discipline, even though it was aware that New York used a lower standard of proof. Even more recently, in fact, just 7 months ago, in In re Tyler Larson, this court imposed reciprocal discipline on a Utah attorney who, like Mr. Barrett, was found guilty of unethical conduct by a preponderance of the evidence.
Mr. Centenaire, can you help us understand your interpretation of the rule in practice? Simple case. Someone in a state that uses a preponderance standard ends up being disciplined with a one-year suspension. As you interpret the rule, the board shall recommend the same one-year suspension, and the differing standard of proof shouldn't matter. This court should then follow suit. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In this case, the Utah Supreme Court imposed what discipline?
It imposed a 150-day suspension.
And the OAE's position is what discipline should be meted out here?
Disbarment.
So that's, of course, a greater sanction.
It is.
And the rule, the plain language reading of the rule that you have presented to us, says the director may argue that the law of this state should warrant the imposition of greater discipline, and in such cases shall bear the burden by clear and convincing evidence. Correct?
That is correct.
So the plain language reading you've advanced would support your coming forward to the court and saying impose a 150-day suspension. Correct?
Correct.
You've now come forward and said, listen, this is a Wilson violation. The law of this state would call for a higher punishment. Tell us why the plain language of the rule wouldn't require a higher standard in such an instance.
It does require a higher standard. The plain language of the rule says that if we are arguing for discipline greater than that imposed in Utah, we have the burden of establishing that either the law of the state or the facts of the case do or should warrant the imposition of greater discipline. And my position to the court is that we have done that. The Office of Attorney Ethics has done that.
Tell us how you've done that.
Well, let's talk first with about the facts of the case. With regard to the facts of the case, respondent argues that Utah's factual findings are insufficient to justify the imposition of greater discipline because those findings were made using a preponderance of the evidence. But what respondent fails to acknowledge is that the Disciplinary Review Board made its own factual findings. If you read the DRB decision on page 2 of the decision, the DRB wrote, quote, for reasons detailed below, we find, the Disciplinary Review Board finds, that respondent committed a knowing misappropriation and recommend his disbarment. Now this
when they say reasons below, that suggests to me that they're relying on the findings, not actual fact finding.
Well, no, that's
what reasons below suggests to me. If they said for the facts developed below, mm-hmm. based on the facts and the out of state matter, but when they say for the reasons below, it suggests to me that what you're relying on is the reasoning of the court and of the panel there in making certain determinations.
Right.
That doesn't sound like an independent fact finding.
Right. I understand what you're saying, but if you'll allow me. Those findings were made, according to the Disciplinary Review Board, following a review of the full record, and that's on page 11.
And you're saying no additional hearing needs to take place if there's a basis in the record presented.
Right, correct. But the review that was conducted was a review of the Utah District Record. It was a review of the Notice of Motion filed by the Office of Attorney Ethics, a review of the briefs in support and in opposition, and oral argument, and then following deliberations, and this hopefully will answer your question, Justice Fernandez, he said, following deliberations, the board issued a written decision in which it wrote, beginning on page 14, it says, based on counsel's refusal to accept those opportunities, and he was referring to the opportunities to proffer respondent's business dispute defense in the context of the Williams and Peterson matters. Based on counsel's refusal to accept those opportunities and on respondent's own answer to the Utah ethics complaint, which clearly demonstrate that the business dispute arose well after he had made these write-offs in return for personal services from those clients, we can conclude only the Disciplinary Review Board can conclude only that the facts are as found as Judge Faust and by the Supreme Court of the State of Utah. Thus, respondent is guilty of knowing misappropriation of law firm funds. So as it is required to do whenever the Office of Attorney Ethics is seeking the imposition of greater discipline, the Disciplinary Review Board reviewed the record and made its own determination by clear and convincing evidence that respondent knowingly misappropriated law firm funds. I think this court would agree that evidence that can lead to only one conclusion certainly satisfies the clear and convincing evidence standard.
You don't dispute that if the DRB said, we see a basis in this record for a finding by a preponderance, that would not be enough?
Correct, for the imposition of greater discipline, yes. Now, after finding by clear and convincing evidence that the respondent knowingly misappropriated law firm funds, the Disciplinary Review Board reviewed the applicable law, the law applicable to misappropriation of law firm funds, including Siegel, Greenberg, Sigmund, and other cases, some of which found that disbarment was appropriate, some of which found that less than disbarment, a sanction less than disbarment was appropriate. And in essence, these cases provide that the sanction for knowing misappropriation of law firm funds is generally disbarment unless the respondent had a reasonable belief of entitlement to the funds taken, or the misappropriation occurred in the context of a business dispute, or and or where there are compelling mitigating circumstances. Respondent had no reasonable belief of entitlement to the funds he misappropriated, nor can he credibly argue that he did. And his misappropriation did not occur in the context of a business dispute. In order to occur in the context of a business dispute, in order to be part of or related to a business dispute, the misappropriation has to occur during and or as a result of the business dispute. In every case, in every knowing misappropriation of law firm funds case, where this court imposed discipline less than disbarment because of a business dispute, the misappropriation occurred either during and or as a result of a business dispute. And I'm referring to Bromberg, Glick, Spector, and Nelson. But that's not the case here. Although the respondent now alleges that the business dispute arose in 2006 after he became a partner, in his April 9th, 2013 answer to the informal ethics complaint, which was referred to by the Disciplinary Review Board, as I stated earlier, according to respondent's answer, the business dispute started in October of 2011 and continued until his resignation in February of 2012. However, respondent wrote off Williams' bill in 2010, and he wrote off Peterson's bills in the summer of 2011, well before the alleged business dispute started. So it cannot be argued that respondent's misappropriation occurred in the context of a business dispute. He nevertheless makes that argument. He suggests that the ethics matter here arose in the context of a business dispute simply because the referral to the Utah Office of Professional Conduct occurred after the business dispute arose. Now, whilst it's true that the referral to the disciplinary authorities was made or not made until after the business dispute arose, the misconduct itself occurred well before the alleged business dispute. So it cannot be reasonably argued that the misappropriation of the conduct is part of the business dispute, and it was not, and it did not arise in the context of a business dispute.
Can we come back to something you said before? You cited the DRB's statement about him being offered the opportunity to come forward and proffer information before the Utah proceedings about the Peterson and Robinson matter and didn't do so. Do you feel due process is satisfied in this second subsequent proceeding where the respondent is not offered an opportunity to come forward here with that very explanation when the OAE is asking for the imposition of heightened discipline? Because basically you are using the negative action of the respondent to prove greater facts than you have in the record before you, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was given the opportunity. Our position is that he was given the opportunity to
do so here?
In Utah.
No, I'm talking about
right.
here.
And
this is the proceeding where your agency is carrying a burden of proof. with respect to heightened discipline. Mm-hmm. So what is it that your agency has done to carry that additional quantum of proof, other than to point to a failure to come forward and give an answer in another proceeding involving a lesser standard of proof and a lesser discipline that was imposed?
No, we base our argument, we say that we've established by clear and convincing evidence that the imposition of greater discipline is warranted based on the entire record that was reviewed by the disciplinary review board. So that includes the entire proceeding in Utah. It includes the brief and arguments contained in the brief in support of that position. And we believe that after we made those arguments, that the disciplinary review board concluded, it made a determination. And the rule provides that it's to make that determination on the face of the makes that determination on the face of the record on which the discipline in another jurisdiction was presented. So that's the OAA's position, that the disciplinary review, that those arguments were made by the Office of Attorney Ethics and were accepted by the Disciplinary Review Board.
Following up on Justice Lavecchia's question, tell us what precisely the board invited counsel to do and in what context and when.
The board invited respondent's counsel to explain his due process argument, the business dispute or the alleged business dispute in the context of the Williams and Peterson matters. He was given multiple opportunities he was asked multiple times, please let us know what facts, what evidence you would have presented that would have shown that you have had a legitimate business dispute, and also explain how that business dispute relates to your conduct in the Williams and Peterson matters. And he refused multiple opportunities to do that.
And I gather from Mr. McGill's brief, and he can speak for himself, is that he believed the invitation was inappropriate because there was no expert in Utah law available to make the presentation. Was that the divide?
Well, I mean, you know, that's the argument. But he wasn't asked, as I read the transcript, for his legal opinion. He was asked simply to tell the Disciplinary Review Board what facts, what evidence would you have presented to show that there was a legitimate business dispute. He wasn't asked for his legal opinion.
Was there a request in response, I'd like the opportunity to present XYZ evidence?
Was there a request by a respondent?
Yes.
No. No. He simply said that in his brief to the court that he could have presented evidence or think if he could do it over again, would have presented evidence of a business dispute dating back to 2006.
Do you ever envision a case where you have a proceeding from another state that has involved a preponderance standard as we have here? You have a level of discipline that's imposed in that state, and here in New Jersey, the Office of Attorney Ethics seeks a higher discipline. Can you envision a situation as an example where you would bring additional evidence in order to prove the higher quantum of punishment that you're asking for? Or do you feel that the OAE will always simply point to whatever is in the record coming from the other jurisdiction?
I think that we're limited to whatever is the evidence that has been presented in the other jurisdiction. Because the determination, whether the Office of Attorney Ethics has established its burden of proving that either the law of the case or the facts of the case do or should warrant the imposition of greater discipline, we have to do that on the basis, or the disciplinary review board has to make that determination, as I said earlier, on the face of the record on which the discipline in the other jurisdiction was predicated. I don't think that we can introduce any additional evidence.
So I'm just trying to understand the practical import of where you started your argument, which is that you accept that with discipline greater than that imposed by the other jurisdiction is asked for in this jurisdiction, you accept that a clear and convincing standard is imposed on you. What's the meaningful difference in that statement then?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You're accepting a quantum of proof of clear and convincing, but you are only going to point to whatever is contained and proven to a preponderance standard.
No.
Explain the difference to me.
Right. What I'm saying is that the disciplinary review board can review the entire record from the other jurisdiction and make its own determination based on that record, based on the briefs in support of an opposition. It can make its own determination. It doesn't have to rely simply on the other jurisdiction's findings of fact.
Look at it in reverse.
Do you understand the difference?
I do. You're saying they can look at the same record and say those proofs would have satisfied clear and convincing as well as a preponderance, as I understand your argument. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. But look at it in reverse. An attorney reviews the file in New Jersey and says, clearly meets the preponderance of the evidence standard, but they didn't put enough proof in my judgment to satisfy the clear and convincing standard. What are you limited to at that point? You're telling us you cannot seek to introduce additional evidence. You live and die with the record that exists, and you would then only be permitted to come forward and ask for the same level of discipline from Utah or elsewhere?
Yes.
But if you were not seeking to rely on reciprocal discipline, would you be prevented from conducting your own investigation and seeking more evidence? For instance, let's say a respondent has been investigated by another jurisdiction. You find that the investigation was woefully inadequate. Are you barred from conducting your own investigation?
No, the rule specifically provides that we may use the alternate procedure of treating that matter as if it originated
right.
in New
you
Jersey.
You just can't piggyback off the reciprocal discipline
right.
system.
Right.
Under
we would have to conduct our own investigation and prosecute the matter, but as a practical matter, it would be difficult, if not impossible, for the Office of Attorney Ethics to conduct complete, thorough, and timely investigation in those types of matters, given the distance, sometimes great distance, between New Jersey and the other state, and also given that our ability to compel the production of witnesses and documents is hampered by the fact that we have no subpoena authority in the other state.
Right.
Most states have a reciprocal subpoena rules, but...
I understand your position. If you're relying on reciprocal discipline from another jurisdiction...
You're stuck.
If you're going with the discipline that was imposed there, preponderance of the evidence is fine. If you're seeking an enhanced discipline, then you're bound by the clear and convincing evidence standard. That's your position.
That's correct.
And your argument is here that you satisfied that. End of case.
That's correct.
Other questions?
No.
Anything you'd like to add?
Just one further thing, Your Honor. Courts in other jurisdictions have considered this issue have determined that no due process violation results from imposing reciprocal discipline from jurisdictions using a lower burden of proof.
Is that even in the case? I didn't see Mr. McGill arguing that.
No, it was in our brief.
Right. Is it a disputed point is what I was asking, and then you're welcome to continue with your argument.
Right. No, not that I'm aware of. I don't think Mr. McGill addressed that issue or the case in Benjamin.
I didn't want to preempt your argument. Go ahead.
Right. Okay.
If you had more to add.
No, just that in Re Benjamin, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, reasoned that It could accept a lower standard of evidentiary proof in reciprocal discipline proceedings, given that the clear and convincing evidence standard it uses is not constitutionally prescribed. And also, because it says a rule that would automatically establish an affirmative of proof of misconduct in another jurisdiction with a lower standard of proof would unfairly insulate attorneys admitted in those jurisdictions from reciprocal discipline.
It seems to me that this issue arises in many other settings. Like, there are civil judgments in other states that may be based upon preponderance of the evidence, and in our state it may be based upon clear and convincing evidence of the case we're brought here. But then the question is whether or not the other state's judgment is entitled to effect within our state. I think in at least in those circumstances the answer is probably yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
No.
Mr. McGill.
Chief Justice, honorable members of the Supreme Court, may it please the court. Now, at the outset, we rely on our briefs before the court dated January 7, 2019 and May 16, 2018. That said, I make the following comments. Simply put, the Barrett reciprocal matter has already been fully and properly resolved by this court. In March 2017, the Utah Supreme Court suspended respondent from the practice of law for 150 days for the knowing misappropriation of law firm funds based upon the preponderance of evidence standard of proof. The Utah court affirmatively ruled that respondent was not a danger to the public and that disbarment was inappropriate. Respondent has been reinstated to practice in Utah since August 2017 without objection, where respondent currently maintains several Utah municipal public defender contracts which carry their own various levels of external scrutiny. Thereafter, the OAE brought a motion for reciprocal discipline based upon the Utah adjudication and recommended that respondent receive greater discipline under New Jersey jurisprudence requiring disbarment for knowing misappropriation of law firm funds, but without recognizing the differing applicable evidentiary burdens of proof between Utah and New Jersey. In its determination and recommendation, the DRB agreed with the OAE and recommended respondent's disbarment. However, neither the OAE nor DRB addressed the circumstances that the Utah adjudication was based upon a preponderance of evidence, but New Jersey requires attorney discipline to be based upon clear and convincing evidence. Thereafter, the matter was before this court, this honorable court, wherein respondent first raised the due process issue surrounding the differing standards of proof, but the OAE at that time waived responding to respondent's arguments in those respects and instead relied on the board's decision, which never addressed those due process issues. On July 10, 2018, the court issued an order dismissing the OAE's motion for reciprocal discipline, noting that the findings in Utah were based upon a preponderance of evidence standard instead of the clear and convincing evidence standard applicable to New Jersey, hereinafter referred to as the Barrett Order. In dismissing the OAE's motion, the court did so without prejudice to the OAE pursuing separate disciplinary proceedings in New Jersey based on the same conduct that gave rise to respondent's discipline in Utah. Thereafter, rather than exercise the discretion granted it in the Barrett Order to pursue separate New Jersey proceedings, the OAE filed and the court granted its motion for reconsideration of the court's Barrett Order. In moving to reconsider, the OAE stressed to the court the impact of the Barrett Order that it would have on the complexities of the OAE's administrative concerns regarding other reciprocal discipline cases, past, present, and future, where sister jurisdictions utilize the lower standard of proof. Now, until Mr. Centenaro stood here and addressed Rule 1:20-6(2)(b), which states that formal charges of unethical conduct shall be established by clear and convincing evidence, The OAE, the last time we were here on order to show cause, failed to mention that rule, and in its brief before this court, failed to mention that rule. Okay. But I submit to you, the OAE presents no new evidence, and has failed to carry its burden to demonstrate that the court committed error in issuing the Barrett order for the reasons stated therein. I submit to you, although the notice of order to show cause is framed in the boilerplate language where it's an order for respondent to show cause why he should not be disbarred, other than to require our appearance, I submit the issue before the court is whether the OAE carried its burden, since we were the prevailing party, to convince the court that the court committed error in issuing the Barrett order. We submit that it has not. Right, simply put, there's no reasonable basis on which to vacate the court's Barrett order. Rule 1:20-14 et al. Governing reciprocal discipline simply does not give fair notice that the facts established in a foreign adjudication based upon a lower standard of proof can and or will be deemed to constitute clear and convincing evidence in New Jersey under any circumstances. I mean, the rule is just silent. And, you know, Mr. Centenaro starts his argument asserting that the rule implies a lower standard. We disagree.
Let's try to clarify, if you could help us, the areas of dispute in this case. For starters, you're not arguing, if I understood correctly, that Utah or any other state, or indeed this state, couldn't use a preponderance standard to make a determination. We have a different standard. You're not contending there's something constitutionally flawed about using a preponderance standard as Utah did.
We concede if the court decides after today to change the standard in New Jersey to preponderance, it has the jurisdiction to do so, and it would be perfectly constitutionally valid.
So the OAE could or could not come into this court and seek a 150-day penalty under the facts here?
Well, in fact, Chief Justice, the last time we were here, my client and I thought about conceding that 150 days was the appropriate sanction because...
Tell me your understanding of the rule.
Our understanding of the rule is...
In this regard, could you come in? Do you have an argument? Had the OAE come in and the court imposed a 150-day suspension?
Not based on a preponderance standard. No, that was...
So you would have argued that was inappropriate, and you argue that today?
Yes.
Then we should look at the rule, because the plain language of the rule, and I'm looking at section 4A4, says the board shall recommend the imposition of identical action or discipline unless, and then it has five exceptions. If the sentence ended there, board shall recommend the imposition of identical action or discipline, would you have an argument?
Yes, I believe the argument would be the same, because the rule doesn't address the problem that this whole matter has brought to the direct attention of the court.
So it sounds to me from that argument that you're asking the rule should have added a sixth exception with regard to the standard of proof, but it doesn't.
We argue that the rule is problematic in that regard, and there needs to be clarification for the board, because the rule does not give fair notice that reciprocal discipline based on a lower standard can be used to impose discipline in New Jersey, which is required to meet a clear and convincing standard.
So then jump down to the paragraph after the fifth exception, which says if you're seeking greater discipline, then you need to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence. If we accept your argument that clear and convincing evidence must apply across the board, then aren't you reducing that language to mere surplusage?
Well, it may, Chief Justice, it may be mere surplusage.
How do you do that with the canons?
Well, it's our position that this problem was never brought directly to the court's attention. There's been no court decision on this issue. The OE is relying on the board's Gorevitz decision, which in our brief, I think we point out, was a mistaken decision. The board in Gorevitz even referred to a part of the rule that deals with judicial reciprocal discipline in the matter, which was an attorney disciplinary matter.
Can we go back to, to the textual analysis that the Chief Justice is focused on? Why would this rule have a provision that the OAE has the burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence for greater discipline, that's what it says, greater discipline, if the clear and convincing standard applied not only to greater discipline, but the same discipline imposed by the other jurisdiction? Explain that to me.
Well, I think all that rule means is that the OAE will be specifically held to that higher standard if they're going to argue for greater discipline. So,
well, why would it be there if for greater discipline if it applies to the same discipline? I don't understand.
Well,
this is
the
surplusage piece that the Chief Justice was talking about.
Justice Alvin, my response is if there's reciprocal discipline that's based on clear and convincing evidence, then the board will impose identical discipline. But if the OAE wants to argue for greater discipline, they have to affirmatively come forward, ask for greater discipline, submit reasons why the discipline should be greater, and those reasons need to be based on clear and convincing evidence, as opposed to arguing aggravating factors or some other reason to increase discipline. As the court knows, discipline is increased for different reasons. I mean, a failure to come to this court could be a reason that the court may increase discipline on a respondent who is ordered to show cause to appear in front of the court. A default can lead to greater discipline. A disciplinary history, progressive discipline, there are other reasons where the court has imposed greater discipline beyond the evidential record. And I submit that that rule means the OAE has to make an argument based on evidence in the record, that's the facts, right? Because the OAE has loosely used the term evidence to refer to the facts under the rule 1:20-12A5. That rule says the sister adjudications shall conclusively establish the facts, not the misconduct, but the facts on which it lies, which I submit means that in reciprocal discipline, New Jersey cannot go outside of those facts, as the OAE argues the board did here. When you're asking the OAE, well, how did the board make its finding? Well, they relied on Mr. McGill not answering questions, and they used respondent's answer in the Utah matter. The answer, that letter, was submitted only, and I said that to the board, and I think I put it in my brief, only to rebut the inference that his argument that there was a business dispute was of recent fabrication. It was not intended to provide plenary proof before the board, which is was a summary proceeding. It's an argument that that evidence should not be considered outside of the record of the sister jurisdiction to make any factual findings in a summary matter. Respondent should have the opportunity in a plenary hearing so he can, you know, not only the evidence by clear and convincing evidence to be presented against him, and also he can submit his defenses and litigate them in a plenary hearing.
Are you arguing that there's any, that there's a constitutional infirmity in our court giving good faith and credit to the disciplinary findings of another jurisdiction that uses the preponderance of the evidence standard?
Well, we argued that it was a due process issue to base the New Jersey, to find respondent Joseph Barrett guilty of unethical conduct on a reciprocal record out of Utah, which was based on a preponderance standard, because New Jersey requires clear and convincing.
You used due process. What federal due process, state due process?
State,
what do you,
state due process, you're not but fundamental unfairness. We argued that it was, we used the phrase due process, essentially arguments would be fundamentally unfair. And I would submit the court agreed in its Barrett order. The court did not make any mistake. Mr. Centenaro's argument, and he used the Sigmund case, that, well, Rule 1:20-6C2B, which states that, you know, unethical conduct shall be based on clear and convincing evidence, only relates to hearings. I submit it is not merited. Okay.
So, going back to Justice Alvin's question, your brief says at page 14 that you're arguing the board violated respondents' due process rights by relying on reciprocal facts to increase the discipline without using a clear and convincing standard. That's still your position?
Well, yes.
So Mr. Centenaro has come in and said, we've demonstrated and the DRB has found that by a clear and convincing standard, disbarment is appropriate here. Don't you want to argue that point and move beyond your constitutional and your plain language points?
No. I don't know that I can move beyond the plain language argument. I think I can weave that into my response. The DRB used facts conclusively found in Utah based on a preponderance of evidence to make whatever findings it did. I don't remember the board saying by clear and convincing evidence in their decision. If they did, they did.
So parse that a little for us. There are facts, and then there is the standard of review through which they should be reviewed. What went wrong here, in your mind? Can the DRB look at the same facts that Utah did with its standard and apply a different standard to those facts?
Well, I don't think the rule is clear on that, Chief Justice. If they can, I think Justice LaVecchia asked me that last time, couldn't the court just remand it back to the board? My answer was, yeah, of course the court can. It's the court's rules. The court can do whatever it wants. Okay. But I think my response was it would not be fair to this respondent because it's not clear in the rules. And I submit to the court, it's no answer. Well, that's the way we've been doing it. If there was a court decision on point that says, yes, it can be done for these reasons, then we wouldn't even be here with this argument. But the court hasn't said that. I submit the record shows that the issue has not been squarely brought to the court's attention. So you have decisions like Gorevitz, which the OAE in its brief says the case they found on point is Gorevitz. And then you look at Gorevitz and you find out the board has misapplied the rule and made statements that, well, the court has said, presumably based on issues of comity, but they don't cite any court decision to support that. And I would submit it's the OAE and the board's responsibility to bring, to highlight these issues for the court so the court can address it. And that's why I use the phrase it went under the radar until now.
Here's what I'm struggling with your fairness argument, and maybe you can help us. In Utah, facing disbarment, the respondent understood that his case would be measured by a lower standard and did whatever he did in order to defeat the claim, the argument that it should be disbarred. How is it unfair then to rely on that evidence and hold it to an even higher standard when he had the same motivation in Utah?
Well,
if not greater.
As we argue in our brief, New Jersey's jurisprudence for the theft of law firm funds includes various arguments based on business dispute. Respondents in Utah, which has no such jurisdiction, does not have disbarment for misappropriation of law firm funds, has Utah counsel. Tries to, in fact, though, not thinking about New Jersey or, you know, what'll happen somewhere else, tries to put in evidence regarding a business dispute, could, and was the judge, that's in the record, precluded him from going into details beyond credibility. Mm-hmm. Now he comes to New Jersey. New Jersey says, well, we have this other jurisprudence, and we want to use that record and apply that record. And my due process argument was not that Utah's procedures or system violated due process. Again, I use the phrase due process. I essentially want to communicate it would be fundamentally unfair to for New Jersey to say, well, we're going to apply Siegel and Greenberg, even though it has a jurisprudence of business dispute, and so you didn't raise the facts that would have maybe relevant in New Jersey in Utah, and we're saying what respondent didn't have that opportunity.
I understand that now. Thank you for clarifying that. So you're in front of the DRB, and the DRB says, what do you have to say? What additional facts would you like to present? Did you ask for an opportunity to make the presentation you've now argued is relevant?
No, I think I said to the board, I think it's unfair for them to put me in that position to, I mean, respectfully, I felt like I was being set up, and not in any illegal way, but anything I said, instead, like, you know, to Miranda, anything you say can and will be used against you, you know, rather than allow respondent the opportunity to develop in a plenary hearing those facts, they asked me. I was not Utah counsel. I'm not licensed in Utah. I don't know what he would have done in Utah. I know what I will do in New Jersey if I would have to defend him here.
Isn't that the argument you've just advanced to us? There was no need to bring this up in Utah because they've got different rules. New Jersey has a different approach and a defense that I could present. Explain to us why you wouldn't have said, if I'm allowed to go back, here's what I would develop, and it would relate directly to whether disbarment is appropriate here.
Well, my argument to the board was you should not be using Siegel and Greenberg in this matter for those reasons. That's what my argument was. It didn't occur to me to ask.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean because of the fact that your client was limited in his ability to present in Utah, so they shouldn't bring up those two cases that deal with a business dispute?
It was fundamentally unfair for the OAE to ask the respondent to be measured by Siegel and Greenberg, which has certain defenses in New Jersey that, in fact, respondent would try to develop. If he had a chance in New Jersey, he didn't have the chance to develop that record in Utah, so it's fundamentally unfair to use the Utah record. Then,
did you ask the DRB for a chance to develop the record in New Jersey?
No, Chief Justice, I said I did not ask them for the chance. I asked them to recognize my argument and agree with me that Siegel and Greenberg to increase the discipline was not appropriate for those reasons. It was the court that offered the chance by giving the OAE the discretion to, when in the Barrett order, to pursue New Jersey charges based on Utah evidence, and we've been standing waiting to see the other shoe drop.
Let's take it out of the context of this case. Let's imagine, hypothetically, a rock-solid case for knowing misappropriation. Counsel for from another state, different burden of proof. Counsel comes forward here and says, there are New Jersey defenses that should be presented. What should happen then?
Well, based on what I know now, standing here, the counsel should ask for the opportunity to develop the New Jersey defenses by plenary hearing.
Just as a general proposition, with a reciprocal discipline case, it's difficult for the second jurisdiction when most of the facts and the events took place in the other jurisdiction in terms of presentation of proofs. Would you agree with that?
I agree.
If hypothetically something happened in Pennsylvania which resulted in a disbarment, obviously disbarment's a different thing, and Pennsylvania has access to witnesses, even potentially documents that are not available to New Jersey, the idea of a reciprocal discipline is to recognize the limitations that are on that second jurisdiction. You agree with that as well? But see, it's very difficult to recreate the record for that second jurisdiction in some cases.
I concede that there are complexities, and the complexities were brought up by the OAE. We don't dispute that there are those complexities. All we're saying is our position is, I'm here trying to defend this respondent now, and in addition, there's these other administrative concerns. We concede that. But we don't feel capable to resolve those, and we think the court has a rulemaking authority, an excellent state bar, and notice to help in fashioning the appropriate rules.
But in bringing up the distinction between the two standards of proof, you're arguing for the ability, I think, going forward to represent the case, or at least defend the case in a different way, and to require the OAE to present a higher level of proofs against your client.
Well,
I mean,
can I say it this way? We recognize in the Barrett order, in dismissing the OAE's motion for reciprocal discipline, which we believe was the proper determination, court also did it without prejudice to the OAE, gave them the discretion. The court didn't direct them to conduct, a New Jersey investigation, but gave them the discretion. And if they exercise that discretion, we think it's more appropriate than using a preponderance standard to disbar Mr. Barrett by reciprocal discipline. It's more appropriate to give respondent the opportunity to meet New Jersey charges in a plenary hearing. But we're not asking for that. We submit the OAE has the discretion. They don't have to pursue any further charges. In fact, we don't think they should. I mean, this matter has been about 7 years old. Mr. Barrett is trying to go on with his life. Utah has found he's not a danger to the public. There's substantial mitigation in the record. He's not coming back to New Jersey. He's just relocated his New Jersey parents to Arizona, where he's living with his wife and his six children. And he's practicing in Utah, but he's trying to relocate and apply for admission to Arizona. But this matter is pending and holding all of that up. And he's no danger to the public. Utah's imposed 150-day.
When was the last time he practiced at all in New Jersey?
Years ago. I mean, I didn't ask him. I think we answered that the last time. I
just
remember,
don't recall.
But more than 15 years ago, he has no intention of coming back. Again, the only reason he was coming back because his elderly parents were here. He's relocated them out to Arizona with him now. I mean, he should be allowed to go on with his life. The court has.
And this matters because of the Arizona bar?
Pardon?
This proceeding matters because of the Arizona bar?
Well, yeah, because while it's pending, Arizona will not, consider his admission there.
Anything else you'd like to present?
Court's indulgence. I mean, Mr. Centenaro refers to Rule 1:20-14A, which states the sister jurisdiction's adjudication shall establish conclusively the facts. He refers to that as a conclusive proof. In the Gorvitz decision, the board makes, they make a statement that the misconduct will be conclusively filed. That's not what the rule said. The rule says exactly the same thing, conclusive proof. And then again, they take from the judicial reciprocal discipline rule and make a pronouncement of what the rule is in an attorney disciplinary case. I try to flesh out that mistake in the in my brief. Now, I do want to respond. You know, again, Mr. Centenaro talked about Sigmund, and he talked about the part of the decision that basically just identifies what the, you know, there are certain sections of the rule that deal with hearing, and then there's sections of the rule that deal with reciprocal discipline. And, the, you know, and I believe what the decision says, and the quote, Mr. Centenaro says that the decision talks about how reciprocal discipline is a limited review. And Mr. Centenaro argues that because the standard for clear and convincing evidence is under the hearing section, then it does not apply to discipline in New Jersey when there's reciprocal discipline. The rules do not say that. And I would submit the difference is the rules under hearing deal with plenary hearings. And if a respondent is going to be found guilty of unethical conduct at a hearing, it has to be by clear and convincing evidence. And that's the standard for discipline in New Jersey. Whereas reciprocal matters are limited. They are summary proceedings. There is no opportunity to develop evidence. It's the facts from the sister jurisdiction are conclusively found by that adjudication. That also means, contrary to what Mr. Centenaro argued, the board has no right, as Mr. Centenaro argued they did, to take those facts and then use their offer to me to speculate on my feet on what evidence Mr. Barrett would have entered back then in Utah when there was a plenary hearing, and then apply an adverse inference when I declined to speculate. All right. So the rule doesn't say what the OAE proffers to you. The Polk decision, which is this court's decision, I submit, is very instructive. The court talks about, in dealing with that matter that dealt with whether the preponderance standard in administrative matters dealing with medical licensing, where there's equal protection violation because attorneys have a higher standard. And the court talked about the risk of error attendant to preponderance of evidence standard versus clear and convincing, why clear and convincing is necessary in New Jersey. And those same principles apply here. And that's why, and court courts
Mr. McGill, as you're looking, I'm just going to look at the clock. I know you reserved 15 minutes. We're beyond a half hour at this point. If you could try to bring your argument to a close.
What the court said in Polk is that application of a preponderance will not serve to generate confidence in the ultimate factual determination. And I submit to you that's what the problem would be here if the court uses facts found in Utah by a preponderance to somehow elevate it beyond the language of the rule, because the rule doesn't say you can do that. Respondent had no notice, okay? And we recognize that we're bringing it to the court. What happened in the past, I don't know whether it was squarely brought to the court, but there is a risk of error in doing that, and that's why we're asking the court not to vacate its Barrett order. Because the court did not make a mistake in issuing it, and that's the problem with using a preponderance standard to, in a summary reciprocal proceeding to find, oh, we find that meets clear and convincing evidence, you know, it does, that does not serve to generate confidence in the ultimate factual determination.
Thank you. Would you like a moment to speak with your client? Because this is a potential disbarment case. If he'd like to address the court, we'll be happy to hear from him.
Well, Chief Justice, we recalled from the last time he was given an opportunity to speak, we did speak of that, and I think he briefly will comment.
Great. Let's do that now.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. I will aptly defer to my counsel on any arguments of law, but having been in at counsel table for the better part of the last 23 years, I can assure you all that it's a much better seat at the table when you are the attorney. I was called a prevailing party in July of 2018 in front of this honorable court. It doesn't feel that way. To your point about what the holdup is, Chief Justice, I am ineligible for any reciprocal applications in any state in the union while this matter shows up as pending. The reconsideration process that was started last July has really put a halt in anything that I may be able to do moving forward. I'm currently an active member of the Utah Bar. I retain good standing in New Jersey, but subject to discipline, which prevents any applications anywhere. I've been living in Arizona for 3 years, and as Mr. McGill stated, I've recently relocated my elderly parents to that state. I commute from there to Utah, where I remain in good standing with several municipal contracts. Since I left the Division of Law in 2001 with an office just down the hall, I have not been counsel of record in a case in approximately 15 years in the state of New Jersey. I don't have any intentions of practicing law in New Jersey. I don't intend to be in New Jersey with my folks moving to the West. I think I will pass through New Jersey to visit in-laws at some local, visit some deceased relatives in local cemeteries. I've moved on with my life. I've been reinstated to Utah. I've been actively engaged there since August of 2017. This New Jersey portion of this case commenced in October of 2017 based on disputes that occurred in Utah that started in 2006. I'm more than willing to put this behind me and eager to move on, and I respectfully ask that whatever decision that you may make, that it be the final decision and that this case be completely resolved as justice dictates. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and thank you to counsel for the fine arguments. Court's in recess.